Hey, everybody. My name is Adam Cresswell, and I am your host for this podcast, which we call Winter is Coming, a housing justice podcast. And we are going through multiple conversations over the coming weeks and the weeks preceding this, all around this topic of housing justice and what does that look like. And this week, we are super grateful to be joined by federal MP, Green Party Representative Mike Morris, who is the MP for Kitchener Center. And it's awesome. Last week, we had the provincial MP, we had Laura May Lindo chatting with us. And now we have Mike both representing Kitchener Center, both doing tremendous work in our community and as well in Queen's Park or in the House of Commons. And Mike has come in just off of a day with a ton of votes in the House of Commons. So Mike, thanks for flying out of your seat, literally in the House to be here with us today.
Well, I'm really glad you're having me part of the conversation. Wonderful to be with you, Adam, and looking forward to it.
Awesome. Before we get into chatting about housing and how that intersects with your life and your work locally in KW when you're there, and of course in the House of Commons, we all usually like to start off just hearing a little more about yourself. And I try to intentionally ask the question, not ask the question, what do you do? Because A, usually we already know that, and B, we find it to be more interesting just to hear a little about yourself and what you're passionate about in life.
Yeah, right on. Well, for my part, I guess I can talk about why I got into this at all to begin with. It's a pretty toxic place in Ottawa, right?
Yeah.
But I think it's important because this is where decisions are getting made that affect our community in really significant ways. Housing is one example. And so I really appreciate that there are a mix of people here. It's not only lawyers. As myself, as I identify as an activist, a social entrepreneur. And now I feel like this is an opportunity to take the platform that this elected office holds to bring forward campaigns that would improve the lives of folks back home. And that's a real sacred privilege I feel like I have, as it's a real honor as a result of having the trust of so many members of our community. Before being elected, I started a nonprofit called Sustainable Waterloo Region. While coming out of university, I went to Wilfrid Laurier. I was kind of upset about the climate crisis around late undergrad, 2007 and 8 is when we started Sustainable Waterloo Region, with the sense that, we might not be able, some friends and I, to participate in these global climate negotiations, but we could have an effect in our community. Mm-hmm. And we sought to get businesses to be part of the solution to the climate crisis, setting targets and reporting back, and ended up taking that work from our communities to then sharing it with other communities across the country. And so I spent over a decade in that work and ended up here as a result of feeling that if we don't address the rules of the game, we will never move quickly enough when it comes to the social justice we need, climate justice, the right to housing, all of these things. The rules of the game are decided by parliamentarians here in Ottawa as well as at Queen's Park.
Right.
And that's what motivates me to try to find solutions that would address the challenges that we're facing.
Awesome. And because we're able to chat directly with you today, I think it would be interesting to know what's the day-to-day like for an MP? You can watch on CPAC and you can see see what the House looks like. And we know, like, as I said today, there were a lot of votes in the House and you were in your seat. Outside of that, what is the day-to-day like for you there?
Well, as I share this, I should also share that our democracy is for everyone. And so that means that the House of Commons is free. It's open. If anyone happens to be visiting family or friends in Ottawa during the parliamentary year, so between September and June, I encourage you to reach out to my office. Would be glad to even give you a bit of a tour. If you'd rather just kind of come on by, you can also do that. Question periods from 2 until 3 or so most weekdays if you want to see more of the fireworks. But our democracy really is for everyone. I should also add that to me, a really critical part of my job is actually when I'm back home, knocking on doors at community events. This role to me is about listening to our community, taking what I hear and amplifying that to policymakers here in Ottawa. And so my days when I'm here are primarily focused on bringing forward our priorities on the floor of the House of Commons. That could be in debate when we're discussing legislation, could be in question period, could also be at committee in smaller groups of MPs when we're studying a particular piece of legislation that's bringing forward an amendment or a position for folks to hear about and then to vote on. And so, the day really flows from time on the floor of the House of Commons, some time in committee, as well as conversations and meetings with other MPs. Part of the best is outside of the formality of it all, but, in between meetings in the hallways, having conversations with folks about campaigns we're trying to build support for. A brief example, we've been working really hard to get support for a guaranteed income for every person with a disability across the country. Folks with disabilities are disproportionately living in poverty. About 20% of the population has a disability. 40% of those living in poverty have a disability. It's, people are legislated into poverty right now, those on ODSP, for example. Some of the progress I've made on this, it's just been conversations one MP at a time that has led to 103 MPs vocalizing their support for the Canada Disability Benefit, a campaign that I've been at the forefront of since being elected just over a year ago. So hopefully that gives you a bit of a flavor of some of the day here. But most importantly of all, I think, is knowing that folks can show up and see their democracy for themselves, for better or for worse. As I mentioned to start things off, it can be a pretty toxic partisan place, and there's lots of room for improvement when it comes to the ways the parliamentarians interact with one another.
Yeah, that's honestly a really good kind of picture of the landscape of what it's like to be in there. And I do really appreciate the discipline and commitment and sacrifice it takes, especially coming from the space of community activist, as you are, to enter into that fray. And I think, like you said, we need more folks who come from more diverse backgrounds. Not that I don't have respect for lawyers too, but more diverse backgrounds who are able to sit there and come from different sectors, and just have different backgrounds and experiences and relationships. And so I really appreciate what you are able to bring to the table, bring into the house. Like that. And you chatted a little bit about the strides continuing to be made to have a more just society for our neighbors who live with disabilities. And so we'll probably loop back around to that as we talk, because it has a huge intersection, of course, with housing and you mentioned ODSP as well. And so housing and income, and this is all interrelated. But even before we go kind of deep into that, I wanted to ask, what was your first introduction to housing and housing justice is a term that we talk about on this podcast as a way to kind of open up the conversation and say, we want to look at something deeper than simply prices on house, or we want to look and not get settled into the idea that there's a crisis that can't be solved. And we want to look beyond it, just facets, and say, what would it look like to have a society, to have neighborhoods and cities and provinces and a country where housing is approached in a just way, where housing is truly enshrined as a human right. And so we use this term housing justice. What was your first introduction to housing and to the idea of just housing? How did it first kind of come to your attention? Maybe before, long before perhaps you were sitting in the house.
Well, for sure. First of all, I love that term. Housing justice is a great way to put it. For my part, it's just kind of my lived experience in our community, working alongside nonprofit leaders like folks at the House of Friendship and the Working Center, as well as those that are, part of the Inner City Health Alliance, folks like those that work at the Sang at Sanguine, that, learning from and alongside the incredible people on the front lines. And then I guess it's particularly though the last 3 or 4 years. And that happened to coincide with when I started to knock on doors. I ran for the first time in 2019. But this crisis is particularly acute, right? Like the last point and count study this time last year showed a tripling from just over 300 to over 1,000 folks who are living unsheltered and experiencing homelessness in our community at a time when house prices have, doubled. It's that exponential rise in the cost of housing, and the fact that it's almost like it's a tale of two cities for our community right now, right? Because there is some real prosperity in our community. If you look at the tech community and the kind of wealth that's being generated, there's room to be proud of the jobs that are being created and the entrepreneurial spirit of our community, while also recognizing those who are being displaced, those on the margins, those who are being left behind at the same time.
And then there's this growing disparity between the two.
Absolutely. Yes. And that's right across our community that's being felt. I'm encouraged. I was, at an event just a few weeks ago, and it was one of the founders of a tech company didn't introduce himself as a founder. Just came up and said, "Mike, I want to hear about what you're doing on the housing crisis, and I want to know what I can do to help."
Okay, awesome.
And so I think it's important that we make these connections too, that there are some in the tech community who are looking to lead and are recognizing the intersections. No one in our community is immune. I like talking about a nurse I spoke with this past summer who shared with me that she can't afford the cost of rent, and she was moving to Stratford as a result. And so if you're concerned about wait times at the hospital, recognizing the connection between that and the housing crisis we're in. No one is immune, no one is buffered, and we all need to recognize that the way we respond to both the housing and the homelessness crisis in our community is already defining and will continue to define the kind of community we live in.
And that was something that came up as I was talking with Laura Melinda last week, is understanding that this is it's easy to kind of have a distance from this issue, or to sort of try and coordinate off and say, well, it only affects me in one way. Like if I'm someone who's able to enter, has the wealth and privilege and luck to enter, the market real estate, you might think, well, it's mortgage prices, and then therefore the bank account interest rate, and it's house prices that are really affecting me. But that's one, that's the end of the housing continuum, and it's one stop along the way of this problem that is sprawling all over. And so to recognize that we not only do we not have distance, like you said, from something that how it intersects with healthcare, it intersects with our neighbors. And so understanding that there are people who are not just members of the community in this abstract way, but living into us, seeing these people as our neighbors. And for those of us who come from a faith background and have a kind of a neighbor love ethic, or grounding to us, I think that's something that we need to lean into more, because it does, as Laura Melindo talked about, it's about imagining a different kind of community that we can have, the one that hopefully we all want.
100%.
Obviously, we know kind of in a straightforward sense, you're able to be part of decision making, and then like you said, you were able to move closer into that table where some of those decisions are made. And even talking about your in 2007, thinking, well, we're not at these kind of We're not at these kind of international deals. You're not quite there, but you're actually many steps closer than you were. And so we know decision making is a big part of it. How does this intersect with your work at Queen's Park or your work locally?
Well, ironically, Adam, it kind of came full circle. When I was elected last year, I went to the climate negotiations in Glasgow, Scotland for the first time, and got to kind of report back to our community on some of the realities of what climate justice looks like. If we were to be serious, maybe we can come back to that conversation for a different day. When it comes to housing, I think it's really critical that we recognize that all three levels of government have a critical role to play in solving the crisis. And the federal government in particular has been, you know, dropping the ball for decades.
Yeah.
It was back in the early 90s. So I used to live in a housing co-op. I lived at Brighton Yards in Uptown Waterloo for a number of years.
Yeah.
And so housing co-ops are one example of, like, not a fancy new idea, but, you know, back in the 80s, I think it was something like 6% of all rental new rental construction was cooperative housing, because both the federal and the provincial governments were subsidizing building out co-op units across our community.
Right.
Well, you know, as a result of a provincial election in the early 90s and this idea of some common sense revolution, that funding ended.
Mm-hmm.
And in the years since, it hasn't been backfilled. And so for decades, we've seen provincial and federal governments not putting the necessary investments into affordable housing. Not only that, though, they've also been creating rules that tilt the housing market in favor of really commodifying housing
yeah.
as an investment vehicle for investors to trade. And this is where I think things are going off the rails. And it's why I think when some people speak about supply and demand and they say we just need to build more housing, it is an overly simplified perspective that doesn't take into account the ways that the market has been tilted in favor of commodification, of financialization, that we need, if we're going to say that housing is a human right, mm-hmm. and the federal government has said that before, they need to then back it up. That means that homes should be places for people to live and not commodities for investors to trade.
Yeah. But
if you believe in that, then tell me why real estate investment trusts are getting tax exemptions that are allowing them to buy up billions of dollars worth of assets. As they do so, they then raise the prices and sell it back onto the market, eroding the affordable housing stock we used to have. It wouldn't then it be a pretty common sense. In fact, this is a motion I introduced just last week to say, should we not just tax the real estate investment trusts like we'd tax any other corporation, and use that money to build more affordable housing? Same thing for pension funds. All this market has been over time progressively tilted in their favor. So from my perspective, using the tools I have available to me as a federal parliamentarian, those are the two angles I'm thinking about, is how can I build support for more investments? Because the federal government has the largest spending power of any level of government.
Yeah.
So we need the federal government at the table when it comes to building, retrofitting, maintaining affordable units. But we also need the rules of the game to be set up in a way that prioritize and lean towards homes as places people live. I think about our parents. When our parents bought housing, they were competing with other people. Now, it's like a Leafs game. You're not competing with people. You're competing with corporations who are buying
who own
billions
all the tickets.
Of dollars worth
that's right.
of that. Bingo. Well, that's not regular supply and demand forces. So we got to talk about supply for who and markets that are set up for who.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you talk about the oversimplification when it's framed that way, and I think that's really important. I talked about this in our conversation so far. I am in no way coming at this as an expert, but kind of acting as what I think a lot of our listeners are, which is a community member who sees that there's a problem and wants to A, know more about it, but B, be able to actually act and say, well, what can we actually do about this? And so I think it's encouraging and it's helpful to understand how a lot of the ways that the problem is framed can themselves be quite skewed. And if that's an oversimplification, I am willing to go out on a limb and have it perhaps what some would call another oversimplification, but that if we want to call housing something that's enshrined as a human right, it can't be that and a profit game, and that just doesn't work in the end. And it seems that we're doing, especially what I see, at least from a lot of the headlines, and I think where people get frustrated with politicians is the ability to just continue to reframe and spin things, reframe them in ways that don't actually tackle the problem, and then therefore create legislation or policies or use those funds that you talk about in ways that, as we've seen, have only actually heated up the housing market over the past few years to a point where it has fallen as the next domino, that because these prices are so high, rental prices have soared too. Right. And so it's not just something saying, well, this affects people who are able to get into the market and you know, we're still able to protect folks who are struggling or who are lower income. But I know personally, folks, particularly in the Halton region, the Greater Toronto region, who families who are trying to find a way to pay $3,500, $4,500, $5,500 a month, just for enough bedrooms for themselves and their kids, and in a neighborhood that is able to support them and has the amenities or public transit that they need. I find it nice and refreshing when we are able to go deeper into that issue than just say, the answer is we need to build more. And I also find it, we talked last week with Laura May Lindo about the need, particularly for newcomers to Canada, who don't have extra support systems in place yet, who don't necessarily have family here yet, and who are able to be preyed upon by this system as well, by corporations who own rental properties or apartment buildings, who invest only in, and I know this for a fact, who invest only in making sure that the grass out front of the building looks nice enough for when someone comes by for a viewing, and that the hedges are trimmed, but inside are doing nothing about water issues or heating issues or sanitation issues. And this is a problem I think I see from, I know it happens in Kitchener and happens in Halton. I know it happens in Hamilton and I'm sure happens all over. And it's something that I don't see being addressed at a federal or provincial level by the parties who are in power.
Reminds me of a single mom I spoke with this past summer. And she shared with me she was in an affordable unit. The wait list, as you know, is like 8 years.
Yeah.
And so she and her two daughters were in an affordable unit, but she shared that she's got mold in her unit. And her landlord knows there's no incentive to do anything about it. She's got nowhere else to go.
Mm-hmm.
And so this is also about power.
Yeah.
Dignity. Are we providing dignified housing and good options for tenants to ensure they can have their rights upheld? And again, that goes back to the rules of the game, and it goes back to those who are in elected positions who can and should be advocating for real solutions. There's no shortage of politicians who are willing to talk a good game on the rhetoric to provide affordable housing. And I'm hearing a lot of talk about, okay, yes, senior on fixed income, young person living in a basement. Well, show me what you're actually going to do about it. And what are you not saying when you only talk about building? You know, if we have all the one bedroom deluxe condos in the world built in our community. I'm not opposed to building more, but we've also got to talk about where are the three bedroom units that those newcomers you were sharing might need, or families in our community might need. And what are we doing to ensure that units remain deeply affordable over the long term?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's something that people experience on the regular. And I know as someone who used to live in Toronto and eventually got essentially priced out of living in Toronto, the frustration on seeing, like you said, more and more of, I also delivered furniture for years. So like I've been in these buildings when there's residents, yep. I've been in these buildings before people go in, when we're just doing like the model on the ground floor that a designer is staging, and just seeing that these are, I guess good for a single individual or perhaps two individuals, a couple living there, but that there was nothing there for families and very little for people who have mobility or accessibility needs or live with different disabilities. And so you talked about this kind of up at the front. I know this is something that you're passionate about and that you're doing. I said on this podcast with Laura Maylindo last week, we're not big enough that I have to be unbiased or something like that. So I can say when I like people and I can say who I vote for, and I don't really care about that. We're not important enough to really, to have anybody cry journalistic bias, but because I'm not a journalist anyway. So I think you're doing really important work and the work particularly around, like you said, combating this legislated poverty that particularly people with disabilities live in. Can you talk a little bit about how you see that intersecting with housing right up front? We know that, and this has been a headline that's gone around and has been communicated, I think, really well over the last couple of years, when CERB was out, recognizing that CERB exceeded standard ODSB, so the Canadian Emergency Relief Benefit, which was important, and I'm glad happened, and that people received is more than the Ontario Disability monthly stipend. And so, what does that say about how? I know we're mixing a little bit of federal and provincial here, but they're going to be interconnected. If ODSB for so many people and friends that I know, I have a friend who literally has a GoFundMe right now, because ODSB just barely pays rent before food or any other living expenses, as if food and rent should be the only things, especially when we talk about the dignity of someone living a full life in a country where we laud. So the ability to have to start GoFundMes says a lot about where we're at. Can you talk a little bit about where you see housing intersecting with a more just society for our neighbors who live with disabilities?
Well, going back to your nonpartisan approach, you've had 2 weeks back to back of two different parties at two different levels.
Yeah, that's true. And we've got a municipal council candidate next week. So we're going all over.
Love it. Let's be clear, though. The Ontario Disability Support Program right now is $1,169 for a single individual per month. And the current governing party provincially is bragging that they got pushed to increase it for the first time. It's not even indexed to inflation. Yeah. And don't tell me politicians don't know how to do it. Salaries like mine as an MP are automatically indexed every year. They know exactly what to do when they're incentivized to do so. But a person on ODSP doesn't have that same. And now they're bragging about this 5% increase in the midst of 8% inflation.
Yeah.
That's disgusting. And the shelter allowance is less than $500 a month. Go on Kijiji and find me an apartment in Kitchener for less than $500 a month.
Yeah.
Obviously, you can't. So that means that a person on ODSP living in legislated poverty is either unsheltered or being supported by a loved one, a family member, a friend, a faith community,
etc. Well, that's what I was going to say. $500 a month is, and I can say I know this firsthand personally, is what a family member gives you to rent out their apartment as a break because you're a family member. So that is, it's so well below the threshold of anything that's actually available.
So it's part of why I'm working on this, because then it's just this very obvious moral imperative about, as a wealthy country, is it not obvious that we've got this gap in our social safety net that a person with a disability is being forced to live in legislated poverty? And the federal government, unlike the provincial one, has promised to do better. So it's my view that we should be advocating at every single level. Someone who is with a disability or an ally of those with disabilities should be advocating provincially for the provincial government to double ODSP. As well, we can also be advocating to the federal government to supplement and follow through on a promise they made in the 2020 throne speech for what's now called the Canada Disability Benefit, to be a guaranteed supplement to ensure that every person with a disability across the country is lifted out of poverty. It's actually the first petition that I sponsored when I was elected this time last year, working with a group called Disability Without Poverty. I think it's really critical that we have folks with disabilities at the table leading the conversation.
They're the voices we need to be listening to and
Totally.
following.
Yeah, so they've got their 12 criteria of what they're looking for from the disability benefit. We got 18,000 signatories to that petition back. That was back in, January of this past year. That then gave us that much more attention from the media and in question period to put the focus and the spotlight. The federal governing party promised pharmacare in 1997. So just because they promise a thing doesn't mean we can expect them to do it. But it does mean that we're not yelling into the void. It means that this is an opportunity to see a meaningful social reform brought forward on something that would improve the lives of people in our community that we know that they've said they're committed to. So following that petition, there was a letter that went through the Senate, 43 senators signed on. I initiated a letter amongst other parliamentarians. Through that, we had 76 sign on, plus another 30 some odd who vocalized their support for 103 MPs. Another MP then proposed a unanimous consent motion where the entire House called on the government to fast track moving forward with the benefit. They finally reintroduced the bill this past June. And for the first day of debate, it was up 2 weeks ago. I was up on the floor of the House just a few nights ago, though, following up to say, when are you going to bring it back? We tried to get another consent motion to move it right to committee and have amendments proposed. A few conservative MPs voted that down. However, we haven't seen any commitments in terms of emergency supports in the short term, when they're going to fund it. And that's what I mean when I say, well, this is just, bringing that campaign using the platform that I and other MPs have to apply respectful but assertive pressure to follow through on something that would improve the lives of folks with disabilities in our community and across the country. And tell me any MP who's going to go in front of the media and not talk about supporting people with disabilities. Like when you talk about finding common ground, there's a lot of toxic partisanship here, but I think this is an area where we had members of every party vocalize their support for this, including the Conservatives and the Bloc, as well as the governing Liberals. I'm hopeful that with continued pressure, we're going to be able to move this ahead. I also believe in the power of our democracy. And so, for those listening, if you want to support, get in an email to your MP. Their email address is just their first name, a period, their last name, the at symbol, PARL as in Parliament, dot GC as in Government of Canada, dot CA. So mine, for example, is mike.morris@parl.gc.ca. And let that person know in your own words why you care about moving forward on the Canada Disability Benefit. Maybe ask for a meeting so you can talk with them about it. That grassroots advocacy, that organizing, the number of emails that have been sent to MPs is leading towards more of them bringing up the disability benefit on the floor of the House of Commons, putting more pressure behind the scenes. And ultimately, the hope is it's going to deliver the funds that are needed to lift up our friends with disabilities across the country.
I, So much of what we have settled for, and we talked about this in last week's episode too, is these Band-Aid solutions, or the there's a deep importance to emergency responses and emergency shelters. But so much, I think, not just at a political level, but I think for us as community members, and I count myself specifically, is that it's easy for us to kind of say, to wash our hands of this when we see an emergency shelter exists in our community. And certainly in Kitchener-Waterloo, there are incredible people, many of whom are volunteers operating emergency shelters. But in so many ways, that becomes almost this desensitizing piece, this numbing piece that allows us to go, oh yeah, well, there's a new shelter up. But that is meant to be an emergency response. That is not meant to be something that is actually tackling the problem. And so I know for myself, I'm definitely guilty of that, of settling for emergency responses, which are kind of the bare minimum of this starting point. And so what I appreciate when we talk about how we can look at things like starting with doubling ODSP and having communities and advocates and leaders of folks who are living with disabilities be at the forefront of telling us what needs to change, that these are looking forward to something beyond just another emergency shelter. And folks at places like House of Friendship and Indwell and the Working Center have been doing this work for years, and they've been doing work that's more expansive than simply the importance of emergency shelters. My hope is that we can see more and more attention paid to how we actually work in solidarity to lift people out of poverty long term, not just in the immediate.
Well, and in the meantime, the emergency shelter system is bursting at the seams. And if for folks that have walked through Victoria Park, or more, even more so at Victoria and Weber, and seen the encampments, you're aware of the dire situation that we're in, both for more emergency supports and for longer term solutions to the housing crisis.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good point, because it's come up in our conversation so far, and will continue to come up, because particularly in our local context of Kitchener-Waterloo, and if you're listening from beyond there, if you're listening from Hamilton or Toronto or so many other places, we're seeing the need to be able to respond to and support our neighbors who are living in encampments. Mike, what would you like to see in terms of the future of our neighbors who are the encampments themselves, and our neighbors who are living in encampments? Because we know particularly for the encampment at Victoria and Weber Street, I know in November is when regionally, municipally, there are decisions being made about what the future of that is. What would you like to see in terms of how we are able to support and show up for our neighbors who live in encampments and the encampments themselves?
Yeah, I want to see municipal, provincial, and federal leaders listening to those on the front lines who've been calling out the crisis for decades, respond at the level that the need requires. That if you look at the work that Joe and Steph Mancini have been doing since the early 80s.
Mm-hmm. These are the founders of the Working Center.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, that there is only so much that someone on the front lines can do without the right legislative tools and sufficient levels of investment. You mentioned Indwell as an example. They've got shovel-ready projects ready to go in two beautiful churches in the downtown. They need the funding to follow through on it.
Yeah.
And so, you know, there is no shortage of those ready to dig in, but we need to be more honest about the extent of the crisis and both the funds and the legislation that are needed to address it, both in the short term and in the long term.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's... It's a great thing to highlight yeah, the organizations that are there doing the work or trying to do the work or are ready to do more work. Trinity United Church, who's one of the producers and people who support the make this podcast possible. They are an example of a United Church that closed its doors, that its time with its original building was at an end. There's still a worshiping community that gathers both in person and online. And they were able to ensure that the new form of the property included affordable housing units, and knowing that even in that situation, there's lots of room for growth, and there's so much room not just for a for-profit property company to have a small amount of units, but for organizations who are dedicated to affordable housing, whether it's building or co-op, as you talked about at the start, that there's no shortage of organizations that can be doing this work. And I know that in so many ways, the government, especially at the federal level, doesn't necessarily, whether they would admit it or not, and maybe I'm talking about more the ruling party right now, doesn't necessarily want to be in the business of actually doing all this work. But then to be able to say, okay, there's organizations like Indwell who are ready to do this work, to connect those dots seems like a critical piece. And those different organizations exist in so many different communities across the country.
Yep. And so we need to be championing organizations like Indwell, like KW Habilitation, like Lutherwood, to be supporting them in getting access to the funding that they need. And there are several funding envelopes federally to then build out the units that we need to retrofit existing units as well, and to keep them affordable over the long term. So can I offer a few things kind of in closing?
Absolutely.
Adam, would that be so for folks who are interested, I mentioned Motion 71 earlier. You can find that for yourself if you Google my name and add Motion 71, or go to my website. It's mikemorrismp.ca. That's the motion I've proposed on the floor of the House of Commons to more fairly look at taxing real estate investment trusts and directing those funds towards affordable units. Listeners that have listened to you and I chatting about this for almost an hour are the kind of people that I know are really passionate about housing and might have a great idea that they might want to share with both of us. And so for my part, if you wanted to share an idea, if you wanted to have a conversation, if you've got a project, if you might just have a story that you want to share with me about your experience, feel free to reach out. I shared my email earlier. It's just mike.morris@parl.gc.ca. Happy to find time for a phone call, for example. That's our democracy at work. Recognizing we don't have to all agree on everything either. Right? It's not a fairy tale, but I see it as my job to be listening to as many people in our community as possible, understanding the needs of our community, and trying to, with the greatest fidelity possible, bring those stories, experiences to light here. I remember a person I spoke with last summer, he said to me at his door, he said, "Mike, I don't know what a real estate investment trust is. My daughter can't afford to live in our community. I just want you to help address that." And so for some folks, that's the end of it, right? Is you go do your job and figure out what it's going to take to ensure that housing stays or returns to some level of affordability. So if you've got something you want to share with me about it, feel free to reach out. Would love to hear from listeners, particularly those in Kitchener. That's my highest accountability. It's the reason why I ran as a Green is I get to not have to give you a talking point. The hope is I just don't want to become one of those spokespeople for a political party. I want to continue to be a representative for our community, to advocate for our community. And to me, the way I keep my feet on the ground and feel accountable is by hearing from folks directly and sharing back the work that is being done. If you wanted to hear more about Bill C-22, if you find me on social, on Twitter or Instagram, it's @MorrisMike. You can see for yourself some of that advocacy. And again, you can reach out and let me know what you think and what you might want me to hear more of too. So, and then thanks to you also. And this is my favorite, getting into a conversation, with a little bit of nuance, with time to kind of dig in a little bit with someone who cares about the issues. This is one of my favorite parts of what I'm doing these days. So thanks for the chance to be a part of the conversation, particularly knowing you've got different perspectives on the same issue. Like, that's the kind of, digging in we need for us all to have, you know, different perspectives and to understand how we can be part of mobilizing for the solutions on the housing crisis, for example, that we so desperately need.
Yeah, I think that's a great word to kind of sum it up. I think you've given us a lot of food for thought and vision for how we do that, for how we mobilize. And because I think that's one of the biggest things. We want to go from just being a people consuming information and learning more. One of the goals of these conversations of this series is not just to inform. We want to be well informed, but actually to be able to be equipped to act and act together and to mobilize. So I really appreciate that. Mike, just before you go, what is maybe just in like a sentence or two, what is one thing that you would want people to walk away knowing about housing justice at the end of this conversation? It can even be re-summing up maybe something you've already mentioned.
Yeah, if we're going to get housing justice in our community and across the country, we need to be holding elected leaders accountable to the simple idea that homes are places for people to live, far beyond they are commodities for investors to trade. And we need to be keeping our elected leaders accountable to policies and investments that demonstrate they're ready to follow through on that fact, so that every person in our community, whether it's a senior on fixed income or a young person that we know are living in encampments,
yeah,
that they have access to dignified, quality, and affordable housing that meets their needs.
Awesome. I so appreciate your time and energy today and your work. Yes, your work over the past year at the House of Commons and in Ottawa, but also as a community member and an activist. And I know even deeper than what we got into this conversation, the ways that you have been supporting people in Kitchener-Waterloo, and particularly in terms of supporting people with just housing. And so I just want to say that as a close, you yourself have been, and again, no stylistic bias here because I'm not a journalist. You have been someone who has lived housing justice for many people, including people that I know. So I'm very grateful for the work that you do in your life and for the way that you lead a life that has that ethic of neighbor love at the core. I'm very grateful for your work, Mike.
Thanks so much, Adam. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. We'll have to see if we can catch you another time for conversation in our next batch of episodes. For everybody listening, we will be chatting next week with Steph Stretch, who is a Ward 10 candidate in running for council in Kitchener-Waterloo. So we'll be going from the provincial up to federal and then slide over to municipal next week as we continue to look at these multiple levels of governments, as Mike points out, that we need to be working alongside the people in the front lines and us as community members. So for Winter is Coming, thanks again, Mike Morris, for joining us. I am Adam Cresswell, and we will talk to you next week. See you later.
Take care.